This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Patrick Douthat's been making music as a hip-hop producer for nearly two decades. He's better known as Ninth Wonder, grew up in Winston-Salem. And as a kid, Ninth learned a music theory in school, in the school band, while he was soaking up the sounds of hip-hop. In the early 2000s, Ninth Wonder gained recognition for his work with the North Carolina hip-hop group Little Brother, went on to produce music for Jay-Z, Destiny's Child, and eventually won a Grammy for his work on Mary J. Blige's 2005 album, The Breakthrough. Along the way, Ninth Wonder started his own record label called Jamla Records. On it, he's continued to work with rising stars in the industry. Here's a sample of his work, a clip from the song Crown featuring Jamla artist Rhapsody. That's a clip from the song Crown featuring Rhapsody and a production by Ninth Wonder, my guest today. Both a producer and an educator, teaches about the history of hip-hop as an artist in residence at North Carolina Central University and as an adjunct professor at Duke University in Durham. Ninth Wonder joins me on the program today. Welcome back.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. It's good to have a little time to get to know you better. You grew up in Winston-Salem, but actually your childhood home, the small community of Midway.
North Carolina.
Tell us more about that.
Midway, North Carolina. It's Davidson County. It's close to the border of Forsyth County. And it was just incorporated. I meant to check and see exactly when the year was it was incorporated, but it used to be unincorporated. We have a town hall now, which I when I went home about a year ago or so, I took pictures. Yeah. I was just floored that we had a town hall, but Midway, yeah. But by address, it's a Winston-Salem address.
Your father built your childhood house in 1977. Tell us more about your parents and your dad, his work.
My dad was a landscaper by trade, is a landscaper by trade still, although I can't get him to sit down. But he also worked at R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. My mom I can't get her to sit down either. She's an educator. She's been an educator since 1973 in the elementary ed programs in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So those are my parents.
He built the house, Dad?
Yeah. Yeah. My dad built the house, yeah.
In addition, so he's working, he's building houses. What was it like growing up in that house?
You know, my brother is 12 years my senior, so my brother tells me about the time, the house they lived in before our house was built in 1977, about they had no light switches, you know. This is in the mid-70s, and my brother lived in a house with no light switches. They had light strings that they pull. Yeah. So when we moved into our new house, it was just a thing for him to be able to turn on and off with the light switch. And, you know, it's just, like I said, this is the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And so it was definitely a big deal. He said, just listening to him talk, it was a big deal for us to have a new house.
Right around the house, just flipping
lights
off.
Yeah. Right.
Your dad's saying, knock that off, man.
Right.
What about music? Was that a big deal around your house?
Yeah, my mom and dad was in a choir called the MPC. MPT Celestial Choir. Marion Pete Thomas was the choir director. And so I grew up in the church and in gospel music and, you know, spirituals, as we call them. But then my brother introduced me to funk, you know, and soul, because he was in high school in the late 70s, early 80s. So, you know, a lot of his high school and middle school, junior high music was Parliament Funkadelic. And the Commodores.
Commodores. You talk about listening to this song, and it really caught your ear.
Girl, I'm leaving you tomorrow. Seems to me, girl, you know I've done all I can. You see, I begged, stole, and I borrowed. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Easy Like Sunday Morning. The Commodores, a big hit, a big national hit. This is something that did this really kind of catch. I mean, you're again, you're in the church, you're listening to gospel music, spirituals. This sort of get your attention, songs like that?
It did. It just had a certain feeling to it, you know. I mean, gospel music already has a feeling to it in itself, but this was something different. It was, it had a different groove to it, and the gospel music did. So, you know, like I say, it was Commodores, and he also listened to Parliament. He listened to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
He listened to a lot of groups, a Night Ranger from that time.
Well, also, I mean, if you get into the 80s, this is another song that you find influential, Cars by Gary Numan, right?
Right.
There is the 80s.
Right.
Yeah.
That was around the time, you know, around this time, this is the birth of MTV. So, you know, your house or your TV in your house went from 5 channels to 40 channels with cable TV. And, you know, we got MTV and, you know, it was Cars by Gary Numan, and The Police was like some of the first people that I saw on MTV, and Phil Collins when he either in Genesis or not, you know, it was just, I fell in love with that, you know.
But just the breadth and the variety of it, and I guess that that is one of the things that MTV did. Again, if you'd been listening to radio, you probably had your station, but MTV really introduced you to a fair variety of music.
I think so. I mean, even in Winston-Salem, we had a station called 1340 at WAIR. It was AM. And, you know, and we also had WAAA, AAA, and, you know, it played soul music, you know, at that particular time. You know, we had a guy by the name of Daddy-O on the patio, and he would play music, and, you know, it would be the thing to do on the weekends. But you know, other than that, that was, MTV was still spoke, it still spoke to a younger generation for me.
Yeah.
And that, at the time, I was like 6 or 7 years old. Yeah.
So here's one that really turned it around for you, I am told. Let's play a little bit of Planet Rock. African Bambaataa, the 1982 song Planet Rock, and music is about to, is in the midst of a sea change right then and there, right?
Absolutely. Even though, you know, the beat machines that Toto and other groups were using for Aha, Take On Me were also using, being used in hip hop, because the guy Roger Lynn, who created the MP, well, what we now know as the MPC, you know, kind of revolutionized the drum machine. And so a lot of these particular sounds were used in British pop rock and hip hop at the same time. So yeah.
Were you tracking these changes? I mean, you are a historian and somebody who cares deeply about the history of everything, but especially the history of music. Was this something you were beginning to notice, the way these influences were coming together? At that time, it was just all sounding good to you.
It was all sounding good to me. But I think early on, I was more in love with what was going on in the background as opposed to what the lead was doing. Certain drum sounds, certain feel, certain chord changes. I didn't know to call it a chord change at the time. I just knew when we got to the chorus in Africa by Toto, it felt a certain way to me, as opposed to other things in music. So,
what was the hip hop scene in Winston-Salem at that time?
It was, you know, we had a rite of passage type place, I would like to call it, called Northside Skating Rink. And a lot of early hip hop records I heard in that particular place, from Run DMC to Afrika Bambaataa to early Biz Markie and, you know, Roxanne Shanté, UTFO, which one of the members of UTFO just passed away yesterday, the Educated Rapper. So that was kind of our meeting place as kids. My dad's younger brother lived in the inner city of Winston-Salem, and that's the point in time where I really got into other types of music, because he was a younger brother. He listened to Marvin Gaye's Sexual Healing. He listened to a lot of other music that I never heard, never got a chance to. So as kids were, you know, as far as when they listened to music, they listened to hip-hop as well. So the scene from a fan standpoint was great. From a practitioner standpoint, it wasn't as deep. It wasn't a lot of DJs around. It was a few, but not like it would be in a Philly or New York or even a Los Angeles at that time.
We'll talk about when it occurred to you that you might be one of those producers and DJs when my conversation with Ninth Wonder continues on the state of things. We'll talk about his experience at North Carolina Central and working with Jay-Z, all of that on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking to Patrick Douthit, Ninth Wonder, Grammy Award-winning hip-hop producer, founder of Jamla Records, artist-in-residence at North Carolina Central University, and an adjunct professor at Duke. So we're talking about your influences. You're listening to music at the time you're in high school. Played clarinet in the band, right?
Yeah, sixth grade. I played clarinet. I went to Hill Middle School in Winston-Salem, and our band director, Charlie Thompson, you know, would call us up and he would pull out different mouthpieces. And he would, you know, if you can't blow a trumpet mouthpiece, you can't play it, pretty much. And my thing was, I failed at that, but I did not fail at a clarinet mouthpiece.
There you go.
And, you know, the good thing about clarinet is it reads the same notes as trumpets, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was just enamored by that idea.
Yeah.
But once I got to eighth grade, I was playing like seven. I was the fill-in guy. Like, you know, we're missing the trombone today. Who's going to play? Like me. And so it became that for me.
Were you picking up? I mean, you can in you know, elementary, middle school band, learn theory if you want to. And was this something that was important to you at the time?
Very much so, you know, because it was a structured environment as opposed to, you know, listening to hip hop at night. The music wasn't as structured. Mm-hmm. There was still some musicality in it because we were sampling songs from the 70s and 60s. Mm-hmm. So that was the thing for me, just to understand how music worked, especially with a bunch of people. I was an all-state band, right. All-county band, orchestra, same thing. So that all was just something that just spoke to me more than anything else.
Yeah, it's nice when you get a little vocabulary around those things you've been noticing all your life.
Right.
Say, well, they got a name for that.
Right, you know? Right. DC Alfine and arpeggio and, yeah. And chromatic scale and staccato and all this stuff.
Yeah. Well, so then, and again, now we're talking about musical influences, and I understand that there was a big moment for you in Public Enemy. When you heard Public Enemy, you realized that something was really going on.
Yes, pretty much. Hip hop was something that we partied to and had fun to, but then Public Enemy taught me something outside of just, you know, how to say a rhyme. Now how can you apply the rhyme to everyday life, and how does that fit you? And that's how Public Enemy just spoke to me.
Let's play a little clip from Rebel Without a Pause.
Yes, the rhythm, the rebel, without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhymer, where you never been. D, the enemy telling you to hear it. They praise the music, it's time to play the lyrics. Some say no to the album, the show. Bum rush the sound, I made a year ago. I guess you know, you guess.
little bit of Rebel Without a Pause by Public Enemy. I'm talking with hip-hop producer, Ninth Wonder, Grammy winner, college professor, and guest on The State of Things right now. Talk about the influence of that song, because I understood it even sort of changed the way you sort of marched into your high school classroom after hearing that.
Well, it was actually middle school. And it made me challenge my teachers in a different way. You know, Chuck D, you know, him and I are good friends. And the first thing I said when I met him was, you were the first black history teacher I've had. And this was seventh grade. And now I'm challenging the idea of who discovered America. Who invented what? Why are we only talking about six black people? Why are we not talking about a myriads of black people that have done great things and for this country? And I learned that through Chuck D first, mm-hmm. you know, outside of the usual suspects, MLK, Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, and, right?
The Black History timeline. Black History Month timeline, right?
As short as it is. Yeah. But for Chuck, it was Carter G. Woodson and Fannie Lou Hamer and Marian Anderson, Huey P. Newton, and who are these people that I never heard before? And Chuck was the first megaphone that just yelled it at me as a seventh grader, not as anything high school. Just, you know, I'm in the seventh grade listening to an album called It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. That was so revolutionary to me.
So it has the effect of raising your political consciousness, but also changing your understanding of what this music could do, right? It's not just party music anymore.
Right. It's a piece of revolution. Every part of revolution, especially in the 20th century, had a musical background to it or a soundtrack to go with it. For the 60s, it was, you know, for the most part, it was Grateful Dead. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Even for the late 60s, early 70s, it was James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. You know, we can go on to, you know, Gil Scott-Heron was right. Protest music, you know? The Last Poets. For us, it was Public Enemy and KRS-One and Rakim and Big Daddy Kane. They were saying things outside of gold chains and sneakers. They were saying stuff like peace, assalamu alaikum, and, you know, being righteous and of being a thinking man or thinking young man or woman. You know, it was different.
Did this make you also see, when you talked about outside of the gold chains and the street life, did you start to see a kind of two-tiered sort of a dichotomy in the music? The fact that there was this commercial sort of bling art, and then there was something else that was far more political?
Well, I don't think at the time it was necessarily a commercial bling art, because at the time we hadn't really figured out how to make it commercial yet. Mm-hmm. We had UMTV Rap start in 1987 by the late Ted Demme. It became the number one show on MTV. It was only a 30-minute show. Because it spoke to a generation around the country. But, you know, I think we were at a crossroad. How can we keep this community-based or community-invented art form? How can we keep it not commercial as this thing spreads? It's like we're at the teetering line. Like, you know, we want to keep it in the communities. We want to keep it amongst a certain amount of people or a certain type of people. Outside of colors, it has nothing to do with being mm-hmm. black or white. It was basically dealing with economics and where you lived and things like that. But how do we keep it from falling into the hands of commercial success and people starting to enjoy it who might not understand what our story is? That's what we got in the late 80s, early 90s. Do we sell out or do we keep it real? Where do we keep our message? What is the message? Whose message is right? Mm-hmm. Whose is wrong? So that's where we are.
When did you decide, or when did you feel like you were part of a we that could make those choices? In other words, when did you want to be part of the industry?
One thing I learned from Music Soul Child, who is a brilliant artist, always has been, he told me, Knife, either you're going to be a part of the music community or part of the music industry. You can learn the music industry, but always be a part of the music community. You don't have to, you know, engulf yourself in the music industry so much because you forget what's going on. And so for me, to be a part of the music community didn't start, as far as the hip-hop community making music, it didn't start to the late 90s, early 2000s. For me to say, okay, I can be more than a fan or this particular artist speaks to me, or I can be like that artist, it didn't start until A Tribe Called Quest. And that's like 1989, 1990, when I said to myself, well, mom and dad won't buy me any gold chains, and I can't wear expensive ballet shoes, and I can't wear this expensive piece of jewelry or whatever, but can I wear a dashiki to school? Can I wear I wear a African medallion? Can I dress like that? Yeah, Tribe was kind of like the common man side of, or the common teenager's side of hip hop, which felt along right with the different worlds and the Dwayne Wayne character and things like that. I could do that. So Tribe was it for me.
That's interesting. I mean, that was your sense of, yeah, when you felt you could be part of that community. Talk more about the difference between the community and the industry, though.
I think the community side of it focuses a lot on how the music feels, the musicality of it. Where should we place the music? What's our legacy? It's not necessarily a thing about numbers. Mm-hmm. What did you do first week? What is your singles going to do? What's the spins on the radio? What's this? What's that? It's more of a, does my album sound better than yours? What is, I want to challenge you from a music standpoint, mm-hmm. not from a, how many plaques I got on my wall. Can I make you come to my studio, listen to my music, and you go home and erase all of yours because it sounds so great? That's yeah. the music community.
But that's interesting to me, because what I'm not hearing you say is it's not necessarily about politics, that keeping it real isn't necessarily being, you know, faithful to a kind of political ideology or political agenda. It's about the artistic.
It's the craft.
The craft itself.
It is 100% the craft. It always has been a part of hip hop music, even from the difference between Public Enemy and N.W.A., although they sometimes, a lot of times, spoke the same messages. They just did it in a different way. Right. It was still about the way the Bomb Squad made those beats sound with Public Enemy, and the way a young producer by the name of Dr. Dre made N.W.A. sound. It was about getting the right timbre in a beat machine, or making a snare sound in the right way, or things like that was way more important than album sales.
And that's interesting, too, because if you are not initiated, the idea that you're sampling, right, that you're pulling beats and pulling sounds from pre-recorded, and you've got a beat machine, it all sounds mechanical, the idea in your mind, if you haven't produced this stuff or listened carefully, is, well, it's all coming from machines, so you just, like, paste it all together, and it's going to be the same sound. But you're talking about some very subtle shades and differences in timbre and texture that you have to get using these mechanical means.
Yeah, what part of the song that you use, does this song have a chord progression that you can use later on? Laying records on top of records to make them make sense, like Pete Rock used to do, or still does, that type of thing. It takes a serious piece of musicality to it. And, you know, we get a lot of flack about using beat machines, but, you know, the piano is a machine with pre-recorded sounds. That is, it is up to the interpreter to make right. sounds come out of it. Period.
Yeah. Well, Shakespeare did a lot of sampling.
Of
Turns out. None of those plots were his. But he did a really, really good job, absolutely. I think, in interpreting them. And some of the others are forgotten. Talk about your decision to go to North Carolina Central.
You know, that decision started with me seeing a 1988 movie called School Days, directed by a young director by the name of Spike Lee. It was the second film. And it just blew my mind what was happening at historically black colleges. I live in Winston-Salem. I was from Winston-Salem. I went to see Winston-Salem State. I just thought Winston-Salem State at the time when I was a kid was a place when homecoming came around, you just go, and it was fun. But I never did understand the idea of what an HBCU was until I saw School Days. And then it really rolled over when I saw A Different World. And that just changed everything to me. What happens when you go to school, and what was the everyday thing, and who is Dwayne Wayne, and he's smart, but he has on Jordans, like, you know, it was this kind of juxtaposed idea of what was going on there. So I loved it, and I said, man, this is it. I have to go. The black of the college is sweeter than knowledge. I got to go.
Here you go. Here's a clip, actually, from A Different World, where this is Kadeem Hardison's character, Dwayne Wayne, talking to the character Whitley, who's played by Jasmine Guy, and they're talking about going to HBCUs.
When you were applying to colleges, was Hillman your first choice?
Of course. I was accepted at Georgetown. When I turned him down, my guidance counselor threw a hissy fit. She said she couldn't understand why a girl with so much to offer like myself would limit myself at a school like Hillman. That's what she told me.
It sounds familiar.
She didn't understand. My great-granddaddy was all but accepted at this certain Ivy League school until he showed up for the interview. He went to Hillman, and he went on to become the first black circuit judge of Madison County, Virginia. He always told me, I was 7 years old.
Baby, you can go to school any place, but no school would love you and teach you to love yourself and know yourself like Hillman.
A clip from the television show A Different World, my guest, hip-hop producer Ninth Wonder. I mean, this just shows you the influence of popular culture. It can be done well and have a real profound influence.
The population of historically black colleges and universities between 1987 and 93 went up 47%. And that was because of the music. That was because of what we saw on television. You know, we're finding ways to put things in entertainment that was swaying us to do the right thing. No pun intended. Spike Lee's third movie.
That's the other movie.
So, and that's exactly what it was. You know, by the time we got to Malcolm X in 1992, it was full blown, 100%, wearing it on our shirts, wearing it on our hats. You know, we were just becoming more, you know, being a 17-year-old, or 18-year-old at the time, and being a black kid, it was the thing to have knowledge of self. It was like the fad to have knowledge yourself, you know, dropping science, as we would call it, dropping knowledge. That was the thing. That was the thing.
And the thing for you was history. Studied history at Central, right?
Right.
What were you planning to do with that?
Teach.
Yeah.
You know, I get a kick of not necessarily being a know-it-all, but to show people things they don't know that's around them every day. That, did you know this? And, you know, to see things, see the expressions on people's faces when I, you know, teach them things, they're like, wow, man, I didn't know. Because I'm not teaching it just to say I'm teaching it to you. I just want you to realize what's happening, what's going on around you, and how it can affect you. How can it affect people around you? So, you know, history is one of those things. Mm-hmm. It is the thing that does that, you know, to know where you come from so you know exactly where you're going. And, you know, it just spoke to me in a certain way, and that's what I decided to take when I got to Central.
So there you are, history major at Central, and then you meet a guy called Fonte Coleman. Tell us about that and the origins of Little Brother.
You know, I met Fonte on my second stint. I had two stints in North Carolina Central. But on the second time I was there, I met him, and I was carrying a Source magazine. And, you know, this is the time where the type of music that we loved is not on the radio anymore. You know, the 1996 Telecommunications Act passed by Bill Clinton changed a lot of things. And a lot of music with messages was leaving the radio.
It created consolidation in the music industry or in the radio industry.
Exactly.
And they were chasing dollars and
that's
least
it.
Common denominator. Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of those particular sounds were being pushed to the back. And you could catch them in Source magazine, though. So I had, you know, my magazine under my arm, and a guy from across the lounge or the lobby at Chidley Hall, the old Chidley Hall, he said, "Hey, man, let me see that magazine." And I let him see it, and I brought the rest of my stuff in because it was moving day. And I walked up to him, and we was flipping through, and he said, "I hate this artist." And I said, "Well, I do too." And he flipped some more. He said, "But I love this artist." I was like, "Well, I do too." So, you know, we became instant friends through music that way, that we had the same likes and ideas of music from day one.
When did you start making music together?
You know, Fonte played football. Fonte is the only one out of the three of us in Little Brother that graduated. He graduated summa cum laude in English. But he played football, and he was doing music at the same time. He was traveling back and forth to Burlington just to do music. In a studio in somebody's back, like, storage unit or something like that, in the yard. And he was doing that for a while on his own. I was making beats in 1999, but I was at the point I wasn't letting anybody hear the music. I was afraid to see, you know, maybe people think it suck, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So I finally let him hear some music, and He said, you know, I don't like this beat. But this one, I like this one, which gave me the idea, okay, I have to make stuff that's better than that. That's kind of like my benchmark now. And we did a song called Paper Lines. And that was the first song we ever did. And it was 1999 in a dorm room at NC State.
Is that just the two of you? It was just the two of us. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you what, we will take a break right here, find out how Little Brother came together, where that went, and also follow the career of Grammy Award-winning hip-hop producer Ninth Wonder as our conversation continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Ninth Wonder, Grammy Award-winning hip-hop producer and college professor, the founder of Jamla Records, artist-in-residence at North Carolina Central, and an adjunct professor at Duke. We were talking just before the break about your group, Little Brother, that came together at North Carolina Central. Let's get a little sample of their music.
Tunes like this overdo me, yeah. Got a nigga about to go and burn the road again. From first gear to fifth gear, out of control again.
And that's the way we rolling in. Needed to chill and take a rest stop, cause my job got me slaving like I'm Dred Scott. Take a break, nah, nigga, you bet not, cause that's when the respect stops. Energy drain, I need a blast like high tech guy, so I can grab the mic and make your head swap. With the microphone, check 1, 2, it don't stop. Out of town on a quick escape, hoping I have a chance to slow it up and hit the brakes and slow it down.
Moving on now.
There's a little bit of speed by Little Brother. My guest is co-founder of Little Brother and Grammy-winning hip-hop producer Ninth Wonder. So tell us about that group coming together, and what was the aesthetic? What held you together as a group?
It's crazy. Then one of the first pictures we took was in front of a brand new Durham Bulls athletic park, which
wow.
is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, we just wanted to do something different. You know, this is at a time where the crunk era in mm-hmm. hip hop was permeating the airways, you know, with Lil Jon and the East Side Boys and all that type of stuff, you know. But we wanted to do something different because we were influenced by things we heard on the internet.
Yeah.
And as well, you know, early 90s stuff, you know, the Tribes and the De La's and stuff like that. But now, you know, is a group called Black Star or Mos Def and Quali and, you know, and Pharrell Monch and all of that type of stuff. And there was a producer by the name of Dilla and Madlib and High Tech. And, you know, we wanted to come from that cloth. And much to a lot of people's chagrin, you know, in the area that we lived in, you know, that was kind of going against the grain. Yeah. And it was, we were told that it would never work, you know, that nobody wanted to hear that, you know. But when you say nobody, most people say that speaking of people in their circumference,
yeah.
not necessarily globally or nationwide. So we decided to strike out on our own and find out our own pockets or who exactly. We weren't concerned about who didn't want to listen. We were only concerned about the people who did.
Mm.
And the internet was the new way of the new means of being able to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because if you say, well, we went on the internet, that sounds like, well, of course you did. But in the 90s, that was the new frontier. Everybody was still listening to the radio, and so they had their own little silo and their own little sound chamber, echo chamber, and you're reaching out. And I suppose that music that you and Fonte hated, those artists that you hated, probably had more to do with, you know, the aesthetic than, right? I mean, it's like, I ain't doing that. No, we're not doing that either. We're not doing that. But you went out and found the stuff, and you also found an audience.
Right. We found an audience, you know. It's funny because, I just recently spoke to, not recently, but I spoke to one of the CEOs of Atlantic Records, Julie Greenwald, who ended up signing us to Atlantic Records in 2004, 2005. And, you know, at the time we signed to Atlantic, they only had one person that was designated to digital marketing, because this is at a time when you couldn't see or know who your fan base was. There was no numbers to quantify exactly who your fan base was. And I said, well, Julie, how many people do you have in your digital marketing place, you know, in your department now? She said, 170. She said, well, you guys were just before your time. So we were living at a time where we couldn't, there was no YouTube, no MySpace, no Instagram, no 2.1 million followers, or what's a follower? There's no followers. You know what I mean? We had no idea to know exactly who was liking our, who dug our music, and we had nowhere to just put them all in one bottle.
But somehow you broke through somehow, because then you got one of your records made it through on, and you were on, featured on MTV.
Right.
So somebody heard it and knew that nobody, there was a somebody at MTV who said, we're not nobody.
Right. You know, and that came after, you know, we released The Listening first, then we released two mixtapes called The Chitlin' Circuit. Fonte was in a group called Foreign Exchange as well. Mm-hmm. They released an album. Big Pooh released a solo. And all of that combined is what, you know, led us to Atlantic. And so by that time is when we got a record on MTV at that particular time. So it took a while.
And then your big breakthrough, because after that record appeared on MTV, then, of course, your first appearance on The State of Things.
Exactly.
That was a big moment
for you.
That was
huge.
Do you even remember that?
I do. You know, I do. And every time we sit down, you know, I say, does people understand how many times me and Frank have talked
about like, this thing?
But, you know, it was huge for me, because it was introduced me to National Public Radio.
And it told me, because every time I'd ask a question, we'd go around, Fonte tell me something, poo, and then I would get a deep history. We'd get to Ninth, and I would get, like, the whole story,
right,
dating back to, you know, prehistory. And it was right then and there I knew that this guy was a historian. But, of course, you had already been long interested in that and been collecting this stuff. So all of this brings you eventually to the attention of Jay-Z. Tell us about that meeting.
You know, the meeting with Jay-Z started with a guy by the name of Mervyn Jenkins. And Mervyn Jenkins was the assistant principal of Chapel Hill High School. And he rapped. This is at the time, you know, we're the age now where adults is rapping. Right, usually 17-year-olds. But at that particular time, he rapped. And we would work together. And he worked with a videographer by the name of T. Smith. T. Smith was from Brooklyn, New York. And he came down, and Mervyn and I took him to Bojangles. We took him to all of the great hot spots here, right? And, you know, we made friends with the guy. And he said that, you know, if I ever knew anybody that needed beats, I would let you know. Well, T. Smith became the videographer for a movie called Fade to Black, which was Jay-Z's movie for his new album, The Black Album. And they were in the studio one day, and he was talking to a friend of mine who was now one of my best friends and now the director of operations for Jamla, Young Guru. And he was talking to him, and Young Guru heard my music, or heard Little Brother's music, from a store called Fat Beats in New York City. And he said, man, you ever heard of Little Brother? And T. Smith's like, yeah, I just met the producer in North Carolina. We went to Bojangles, and he got me a four-piece wing dinner and some dirty rice. I never had dirty rice. And he's like, man, you know him? He's like, yeah. He said, call him. And, you know, it's a testament to so many things. Be mindful of who you meet and how you treat them, because you never know who they know. Watch the toes you step on, because you never know the leg it's attached to. So he called me, and he put Young Guru on the phone. And that's how I got to Jay-Z.
And then tell us about that meeting then, when you're finally, because it's interesting too, because on that list of artists that you may not have approved of early on could have been Jay-Z, right?
It was.
Yeah.
Jay-Z. You know, it was you know, Jay-Z at the time, you know, this is after his debut, Reasonable Doubt, and once he got into In My Lifetime, Volume 1 and 2 and 3 and The Blueprint. You know, Jay-Z became the, for us who search for music on the internet, and we were so-called, now we're labeled, now we're called the underground kids or the backpack kids, is what we're called. You know, Jay-Z was like the antithesis of all of that. He talked about women, he talked about popping bottles and jewelry, and we were like, no, 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 no. So now here I am in the studio with a guy who I thought was against the culture,
yeah,
right, in my young frame of mind. Once I got in the studio with him, we started talking about music, and the one thing that struck me, he didn't ask me to change my music. You know, it's this whole thing that you go to in the music industry and they ask you to change who you are. This guy didn't ask me to change who I was. He wanted me exactly how I was. And I was like, wow, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I'm missing the idea of who is in power, who's ruining the culture, who's saving it, who's... Now I'm confused. I'm like, this is not the narrative that I came up with on my own. And, you know, we did a song called Threat. And for me, being the backpack kid and the underground kid is the most merciless and bloodiest song on the album.
tell me how that song. There's a great story that you tell about how that song came together, because he had an idea for Threat and he wanted you to come up with a beat. Tell us how it went.
He sat down and he said, "Man, you got a lot of beats." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, I got a song called Threat. I want you to use this song, R. Kelly, A Woman's Threat." And this is another thing. I had totally turned R. Kelly off for various reasons, you know, little things he had going on. But I turned him off and tuned him out, and he gave me this song. And I said, I hadn't heard this song. And I listened to it, and I said, man, what can I do with it? And 25 minutes later, it was a beat.
I want to just play that song, because I want you to listen to this and see how it transformed. But this is the R. Kelly's A Woman's Threat. Let's listen.
My man, my lover, my king, my life, my chance, my fall, my guts, my courage, my wounds, my fence, my neighbors, my yard, my chains, my lock, my God.
Okay, hip hop with a straight up R&B kind of a thing, very slow too, and you get that. But also something, because something else he told you, he wanted to give it that New York sound, right? You needed a New York influence, the New York bounce, as it was called, right?
Which was, you know, a sound that we attribute a lot to a lot of early 90s producers, but more than anyone, DJ Premier. He was probably the one that we would say, if it was a New York sound, DJ Premier was it. And so that's what I wanted to kind of give it, but with a new flavor to it, you know? And... like, it was an R&B song, but how can I take this song and speed it up without changing the pitch? Now, here comes the music stuff. Here comes the whole, you know, stuff I learned from band. Yeah. How can I keep the same pitch but speed it up, right? And so now I have to, now it turns into cutting time signature now. Now it's, you know, 4/4 time, making 4/4 times, you know, speed up. Right? It's that type of stuff that I had to put into play, and that's how I came up with the beat.
So you got the R. Kelly in your ear. Now I want to play this a sample of New York Bounce just to give you a sense of what the beat is going to be. You got about less than half an hour to pull this together, and here is what you ended up with.
Told you, nine on me, stop with me. Must got nine lives. Ninth wonder, put that for you. Take a little bit of life from you. Am I frightening you? Shall I continue? I put that to you. I let it sing you a song. I let it hum to you. The other one sing along. Now it's a duet, and you wet when you check out the technique from the two. And I don't need two lips to blow this like a trumpet, you dumb. This is an unusual musical. I conduct it. You looking at the black Warren Buffett, so all critics can duck sick. I don't care if you see Dolores Tuckett or you Bill O'Reilly. You won't even.
A little bit of the song Threat on the Black Album by Jay-Z and produced by Ninth Wonder, who's in the studio with me now. And then he went into the studio, right, and started to record right then and there.
That was the moment in time that I put in my mind that Jay-Z was the Michael Jordan of rap, because, you know, with MJ, I've. I've always attributed him to having no weaknesses in his game. Jay-Z was the same way. It wasn't nothing he can't do. It wasn't a crowd he can't reach. It couldn't reach. Here's a guy that I had pegged to be so much commercialism, this and that. But once he did Threat, even songs before it, you know, from the Blueprint and, you know, albums like that, and even Reasonable Doubt, I'm thinking, yo, his wordplay is out of control. Like, how do you put together words? It's one thing to say rat, cat, hat, sat, bat. It's another thing to say, when the gun is tucked, untucked, you die like nunchucks held by the jet L.I. I'm the one not meaning no one must try. No two, no three, no four, no why. Because 1, 4, 5 might blow your high. Like, that takes a skill set that you can't. That was something else. So he goes into the booth and he does it, and he says my name on the track. And that was the moment in time I was like, wow, like, this is crazy. And Jay-Z was the only rapper at the time that was making producers famous. Most producers makes rappers famous. Jay-Z was making producers famous, and that was my time.
Which suggested that he understood the value of producers and knew that it was more than that. And if you're going to put all those words and get the beat and the rhythms right, finding somebody who knows how to cut the time, keep it the integrity, is going to be critical to his success, which leads you to somebody like Kendrick Lamar and working on Duckworth. Tell us about that.
You know, that was... And I had done so many things in between, you know, six albums with my buddy from the West Coast, MERS, album with Gene Gray, 3 albums with Buckshot, 1 album with David Banner, you know, Mary J. Blige, Erykah Badu, 3 songs with Destiny's Child, Anderson .Paak, Jill Scott, Rhapsody, BJ Chicago Kid. Like, I've done it's been a long way from then till now. And then we get to Duckworth, which, you know, Kendrick was a kid who I met in 2010, and he tweeted me, and I missed the tweet. This is around the time I just got on Twitter. I wasn't too familiar with it. And this is before he put out his release, Section 80. And, you know, shouts to TDE, shouts to, you know, to Top Dog Entertainment, you know, him, Schoolboy, Ab, J-Rock, everybody, you know. But he tweeted me and said, man, I just want to bless one of your beats. This is 2010. And what I didn't understand about Kendrick and Drake and Big Sean and Big Crit and Mac Miller and all of these people, while we were, little brother, were doing our thing around the globe and on the internet, we were raising an entire generation of kids that was seeking us out on the net. Just like we were making fans, we were making artists, and we didn't even know it. So Kendrick was one of those kids. So, you know, I end up meeting him the next day, still not knowing that he tweeted me. And he was like, man, I just want to do something. I said, okay. You know, and time passed on, and I put him on a song with a group on my label. The group is called Actual Proof, and I put him on a song called Super Genius. And then I put him on another song called Enjoy, West Coastin'. And that's what it was. So when we got to Kendrick, you know, after To Pimp a Butterfly, and after the album Damn and The Good Kid and all this stuff, we get to Duckworth, and, you know, he took 3 of my beats he chose out of a pool of 15 and took 3 of those and made a song about how his dad and how his label boss had an encounter, and it could have went bad, right? But it didn't, and now he's here. And it's the last song on the album, and it was incredible.
Incredible hour we've just spent together. Always great to talk with you, Ninth Wonder, and we've left a lot on the table, so I guess you'll just have to come back.
I guess so.
Ninth Wonder. He's the founder of Jamla Records, artist in residence at North Carolina Central University, and an adjunct professor at Duke. You can find out more about his work at our website, stateofthings.org. By the way, I want to point out, for our next Movies on the Radio, we want to know your pick for favorite or least favorite superhero film. Send us an email at sot@wunc.org or #SOTMovie. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio. Fellowship with demons and relatives, I'm a star. Life is one funny mob.